I'm super happy. Are you happy? Welcome to the Be You, Find Happy podcast. Here you'll find tips and tricks to inspire you on your way to happiness, to live a courageous life of authenticity, and learn how to speak your truth with grace. I'm Michaela Johnson, and welcome to our podcast. Dr. Stan Tatkin, welcome to the Be You, Find Happy podcast. I have to tell you, I have read most of your work. I am so impressed with what you do with the PACT Institute, and I am really excited to have a conversation with you today about, you know, attachment in general and your new book, In Each Other's Care, A Guide to the Most Common Relationship Conflicts and How to Work Through Them. Could you share with the listeners a little bit about you and all your incredible backstory?
Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Michaela, for inviting me here today. So you want to know about my backstory? You mean my prison life? No, I'm kidding.
I've had a few on here, I'll tell you.
What kind of backstory? What part of my backstory? Because I could go all the way back to my birth.
Well, and you know, since we're going to talk about attachment, that is a primary important factor, right? How about the headlines? We'll go for the headlines.
Well, actually, since you mentioned it, no one's ever really asked me that. I grew up in a very loving family. My parents were extraordinarily happy together, and always looked to me that they were in love to the very end. They did a lot of things that I write about in terms of being secure functioning and in each other's care. Of course, they did a lot of things that weren't so great. You know, one of them had to do with, I grew up in a show business family, so I was a musician I started performing when I was six. That's an extraordinarily young age. And that has an impact on somebody to be center stage because of music. And so I worked professionally in the first part of my life until I was 17 with my brother. We had record contracts and we did a lot. And then I went back to it when I was 17 and started to do even more professional work. And then I gave it all up at around 26. And for various reasons, I just grew out of it, and I found my way eventually to psychology and never looked back. So I'm grateful for the choice I made, and I still do music in some ways in my work. I think musically. So all of that really, it's funny when we look back. Our life can make more sense, of course, to us than when we're actually in it and moving forward. The fog of the future, is blinding us to make sense of why we pick what we pick. But it all makes sense to me now. And so, I was trained in a lot of different approaches. I went through a lot of growth and a lot of pain in my process of becoming. What I do and what I feel like I am today. So without boring your audience, I was trained in a great many approaches and trained with many, many mentors who I give credit to in all of my books. And that really gave way to a psychobiological approach to couple therapy, which is a polytheoretical approach to secure functioning, which is our goal. Secure functioning is basically a series of social contracts made between people in a free society or free union that is fair, just, and mutually sensitive, collaborative, and cooperative. So that's secure functioning. It is a way we unionize and ally with each other. All unions. And unfortunately, the couple union is the only one that operates under different rules. rules that are often not even discussed. It's mostly for love, attraction. There are many reasons why people pair bond. And that's part of the problem, that there are no centralized sense of shared purpose, shared vision between partners other than emotion. And that's part of the problem I write about in this last book, which was written during COVID, that any couple, just like any union, that does not have a structure that is co-created by the creators, in this case, a two-person system with two partners of equal power and authority. If they don't co-construct this house that is their relationship or this plane that they plan on flying, it will not work. They will have trouble because they're basically operating under no structure except their own separate ideas of what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad. And that will lead to fighting. So structure turns out to be a really essential part of any union that wants to last a long time and be happy. Did we co-create this culture ourselves, or did we just leave it to our memory and our experience in our childhood? And then we are not actually drivers of this car. We're passengers to our history, right? So it's a very, very important issue. That's number one. Number two, the manner in which human primates interact when one or the other is under stress is the second biggest problem that will lead to dissolution of any relationship over time because of a biological threat system that accrues in memory and makes the other person increasingly unsafe. That's, again, all human beings, no exceptions. So does that answer your initial question?
Oh, it so does. And, you know, I got a sample of your book from Ellen Bader, who I happen to be an on-staff psychotherapist at the Couples Institute. So currently in my doctorate program for clinical sexology. So much of what you say I align with.
Michaela. Michaela, guess who Tracy, my wife, and I are vacationioning with right now?
No, are you kidding? It's Ellen and Peter. That's fantastic. Well, let her know that Michaela said hello.
I will.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. So that's how I came to this particular book, but I've read your work in so many other contexts. I've watched a lot of listened to a lot of the podcasts that you've been on. And one of them, as a matter of fact, that I recently listened to, you were talking with a gentleman and you said, love is not enough. And I literally was like applauding this whole thing because it is so important. And I love the things that you talk about in terms of the pacts and the agreements that we need to make to have a free union, right? And the guardrails that need to be in place. And I also have, you know, chosen monogamy as my journey. And, you know, that's not necessarily all of my clients' journeys, but regardless of whatever the journey is, there does need to be these kind of ground rules so that we know what context we're playing within, you know? And I think that couples get into a lot of trouble when maybe their child parts of self or their teen parts of self aren't able to get a healthy adult on board and start expressing needs in a way that can be received. And then we have these situations where somebody's feeling resentful, they're blaming, they're criticizing, stonewalling, all of the things that couples start to do, and the walls of resentment just get bigger and bigger and bigger. That's at least the couples that I see when they come to me. That's usually the space that they're in.
Well, they've played it badly. They've played it as a solo sport when it's actually a team sport. And that's a different orientation than what most people come to the table with. They may think they're going to be a team, but they don't orient that way. And that becomes a central problem. When you and I are even under a little bit of stress, we will, because of our survival instinct, we will begin to act and think and talk like a one-person psychological system of me, my, I, and you. That always appears unfriendly to the other person, who now feels compelled to operate in the same way. You keep doing this over and over again. You begin to accrue memory that is threatening. You feel resentful. There's a lot of injustice to make up for. And this actually snowballs, and people don't realize that this is not a him or her problem or a cultural problem. It's not anything other than a human primate problem. Across the board, this is the human condition that we have to learn about and watch out for.
And one of the things that you touched on that I really would love to talk more about is that when I'm working in the context with couples, I like to say, there is an I, and there's a we. So yes. You're an I showing up to a team, right? So there's the individual that needs to be there to express, you know, needs, wants, desires. And there's the individual that needs to be able to receive the needs, wants, and desires of their partner, which may not be in alignment with their own. And actually, probably are not.
secure. You cannot be secure functioning unless you're fully individuated and an autonomous, free thinking human being, because the dyadic system, which is not predicated on romance or love, it gets you in the gate, because nature doesn't care about relationships. It only cares about continuation of the species, and then you're on your own. So if we want a long-lasting relationship of earned love, earned respect, earned appreciation, admiration, we have to do things that are based on principles that we set up, you and I, based on a purpose. We're going to protect each other in public and private. Why? Because we can, and because the alternative is bad. And that's what we would get anywhere. But we're going to decide to play this better. We're going to be on each other's side always, ride or die, because that is going to be our world that we co-create. The question is, do we do that when we're angry with each other? If it's purpose-centered, yes, we must. It's not based on emotion. It's based on purpose. That gives rise to positive emotions of safety and security and trust. So the mature adult is what secure functioning is aimed at. Two autonomous individuals coming together in a symmetrical relationship based on conditions and terms. It's a deal or no deal. It cannot be based on emotion, because emotion is fleeting. It changes with the wind. And if that's where you're basing your life, it's going to be as a roller coaster as emotions are. So it has to be based on something else. And that is, this is what we're going to do, and this is what we're never going to do. So say us both, not somebody else, right?
It's, yes.
Yeah, we're going to decide what's good and what's right. Nobody else. That's our job.
Yes. And I love to use different kinds of these little life analogies and examples with my clients. But one of them that I love to say is, conflict does not mean we're throwing oranges at each other, right? Conflict is,
unless you like
Mexican food for dinner, right?
If I'm hungry.
If I'm hungry, throw an orange at me. is that I want Mexican food for dinner. I want Italian food for dinner. Okay, well, now we're dealing with a conflict, and we need to have an outcome. How are we going to resolve it? And right. I think when we pull the emotions out of it and just realize that, you know, there's a problem that needs to have a solution. And in my client sessions, I'll often say, you can look outside and say the sky is blue. You can look outside and say the sky is gray. And I can look outside and say the sky is periwinkle. And we would all be right, because that is our individual human experience. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that we need to fight to change our partner's mind, but rather get wildly curious about, well, tell me about how you see the sky is blue. Like, really try to get an understanding of where your partner is coming from and what their experience is, so that you can start to come up with the terms, you know, or the move ahead, whatever it's going to be.
I have a better idea. Your idea, it's not actually that's incorrect. I don't have a better idea. I have another way, a simpler way of
I love it.
Of bringing about. Because what you're talking about is the social emotional capacity to create consensus. You want Mexican food, I want Italian food. The good news is we both want to eat. We both want food. We are the same. We agree. We move up a level to where we do agree. Now, where we are different, we can make arrangements for. How about, sweetheart, let's go to Mexican food tonight and let's go to Italian tomorrow. What do you say?
Yes, no or problem. Even better, let's go to that food truck festival that's got all the different, we'll meet in the middle.
Awesome.
But I love it. Exactly. Is it Taco Tuesday? Because then we're just going to Mexican. I mean, awesome. Just get on board with that. Okay.
And what do you do with the sky? If instead of saying, well, we all are right, you're going to get an argument. So, but we all notice that there is a sky. Right. So, yes. It doesn't matter. The other part is vive la différence. But we all see the same, a sky. And that is the way we have always done it throughout human history, the way we've gotten people who are completely different than us. We would otherize them and eliminate them if we could back then. But let's say we couldn't afford to. I can't eliminate you because I need you, my enemy, to help me with this bigger enemy of that we both have. So, hey, now we're the same. We're the same because we both have the same mission, purpose to stay alive. That flattens the field. So that does it for us. But let's say we want to do commerce. How do we do that? Because we both want to do commerce. We're going to have to find where we agree and where we're the same. Not where we're different and where we disagree. It's a no deal. So we've been doing this since the very beginning because we are pack animals that are dependent. People have to understand that that is a fact. We are dependent animals and we gather in packs. So we're social. Now the question is, how do we be independent while still being connected based on shared purpose, shared vision, and shared principles of how we're going to keep each other from harming each other. That's governance, right? That's easy to do if you must do it. Partners, for some reason, don't think they should have to do it. They think they're there for whatever reason. They have their own expectations. They think they're family, which is not true. They're strangers always. Only their children, blood, are family. They're strangers constantly trying to get to know each other. But we always take the easiest way because of energy conservation, and we will become overly familiar with each other without actually paying attention and knowing each other. We think we know each other, and then we take liberties. We have entitlements, and this is why couples have a very short-lived experience, at least as happy couples, because they don't play by the same rules that everyone else has played by since the beginning of civilization. They think they're in some other system here.
you're absolutely right, and I'm just chuckling because, you know, there's so many different scenarios of this. I had some clients the other day, and the way that they were talking to each other, I said, this is like you walking into Starbucks and saying to the barista, you need to give me a double white mocha right now.
and people do that.
And it doesn't ever go very well, right? Like, that's just not how we should be showing up in this human existence of ours. And I think you're so right, though, in that, you know, we will treat perfect strangers, perfect strangers, with more courtesy and less audacity than we treat our partners a lot of the time. And I think that kind of plays into that expectations and entitlements that you kind of hinted at.
Yeah. And it's very dangerous. And it's also very young. It's not a grown-up way of operating because a couple really is a survival team. And I could prove that. You and I get together and we're, you know, if we decide we're in a committed relationship, we will affect each other's health, either positively or negatively. If our relationship is insecure functioning, filled with interpersonal stress that's chronic, we're going to die sooner. We're going to get sick. We're going to have mental, emotional problems. We know this for a fact. So just being together isn't enough. We have to make the relationship and shape it into our image, the two of us, as we go. Everyone can do this, but they have to know they must do it, or they're flying without a net. They're flying according to memory only. We're memory animals. That makes our life easier because we don't have to think as we're driving to the car and brushing our hair and talking on the phone. But it also can be a disaster. That's how you get into car accidents. That's how you misunderstand your child. That's how you think you understand your partner, but you shoot first and ask questions later, because most of the time we're operating by memory, and even worse, by pattern recognition, in which case we can be easily misunderstood and misunderstand and also feel threatened by our most loved individuals. So this is a human problem. And we live in a culture where we're categorizing everybody. I'm as guilty as the next person with Wired for Love, coming up with Anchors, Islands, and Waves, which is a real thing with attachment. But it was never meant to be used as a cudgel to beat each other up with or oneself, right? It's a misuse.
Right.
It's there to understand yourself so you can be better, or to understand your partner so you can be a better partner. But that's not what we do.
Well, so. I got to shout out this first chapter, the first chapter title, because it is just so funny. And I'm flipping through here to find it because I flipped away. It says, "The problem of being human, also known as, we are all pains in the ass." And I think that is just so spot on, and we're dealing with this constant influx of being in different emotional states and having different thoughts and perceptions. You know, my partner and I recently, you mentioned the airplane analogy. We actually opted to have him do my instrument flight training, which is a very high stress.
I know.
Incredibly high stress, very detail oriented.
By the way, I'm instrument rated, so I went through it. I know. How wonderful for you, though.
And we survived. We survived it because he and I happened to pick up in the right way in terms of energy. So, you know, when I'm high stress, he's high calm. And there's a lot of this energy balance and flow happens. But there were a couple of hot minutes where I saw his dysregulation and I'm like, oh, he's activated. I need to not be as activated as I am now. You know, I need to just take a deep breath and sort of a thing. But it's really interesting when we talk about stress and we talk about, you know, activations. And I often will tell my clients that, you know, you've got to have some level of awareness on where you're showing up, because your partner's been with you for long enough. And even if they were with you for 5 minutes, humans have survived as long as we have, because we can pick up on all the things from your scent to your nonverbal cues. And if there's a fire coming in the building, I'm not going to be casually hanging out and talking with you. I'm going to be knocking you out of the way so I can get myself out the window. I may even knock you out before me so I have a safer landing, but it's not to save you.
Use my body as a cushion when you fall.
That's right. And I think that, you know, couples don't often realize when they're, you know, it's like, I'll have them say, you know, he walked through the door and I could tell he was upset. Well, he walked through the door and could tell you were upset because he forgot to take out the trash before he left in the morning, you know, and all of those nonverbal things that come up that our human minds are so adept at picking up on for our own survival. And now suddenly we're not having a rational conversation. We're in an emotional state of survival. We're in defense mode.
My research was on videotaping hundreds and hundreds of couples using digital video and analyzing video frame analysis, something that Dan Stern did with babies. And this is how I was able to prove that real time is too fast for all of us, that we are acting and reacting at lightning speeds through pattern recognition subcortically. And these subcortical systems are linked into our survival instincts, into our fear centers, so that I could come in and see you and anticipate that you're going to get angry with me, and so I'm afraid, and you will get angry with me without my realizing that in my thinking you were going to, in my being fearful, I actually appeared more threatening to you without knowing it. And so this is the phenomena of us. We can't hear or see our own faces, can't hear our own voices. We're not in the head of the other person. We don't have their sensory, motor sensory experience and their memory. So things are never what they seem. I think that I am feeling a certain way. I think I'm talking softly, but one person's whisper is another person's yelling. When we add another person into the mix, everything becomes extremely, difficult. When we go live with another person, we fall back on automation and memory and reflexes. We think we're right, but we're not. We think we're not making mistakes, but as our heart rates go up, we're making more and more errors in communication, memory, and perception than we actually realize. But we are so oriented and organized according to our own personal narratives, and we don't realize that those narratives are designed for our interests only. That my narrative takes all that I know as to why I'm in pain and proves that it's you that is causing me difficulty. That is a personal narrative. Everyone has one, and it's always organized to win, to be right, and to point outward at the cause of our troubles. So again, the human condition. Everywhere on the planet, people do this. They do the same things.
And it's a heck of a ride to override it. I mean, I often will say to my partner, I'll say, you know, my story is, or my narrative is that this is happening, to, as my like full stop, pause, time out, to try and get myself in check and not project what I, you know, everything onto him. And then oftentimes, you know, what I'm projecting or presuming or what my narrative is actually not at all where he's coming from, which is rather interesting. He says, oh, you know, no, actually I just ended up hanging up the phone a second ago with so-and-so and I had this on my mind. And it was actually nothing that I'd done, but his body language had, you know, had prompted something in my mind that said, warning, you know?
Yes. Secure functioning, just so your audience understands, secure functioning means if I'm your partner, I am able to tolerate pain. I'm able to grieve. I'm able to accept disappointment in the fact that all people are disappointing. All people are a pain in the ass. All people are irritating and annoying. There is no more difficult thing on the planet than another person. I accept that. So what? I also accept the fact that we are different. I don't complain about it. Of course we're different. I don't highlight that. I look to where we agree and where we are the same, and that is where I get you on board with my wishes or my fears. That's how I do it. That's how you do it. And so because we're doing it that way, we tend to focus on problems, not each other as the problem. People have to understand, if you're not working the problem together, but you're working on each other, that's war.
Super radical concept. I mean, it's a super radical concept to say, let's find the ways in which we're similar and same and start from there, and then we can ladder back.
Yes.
I really love that. I mean, I think that's just such a great way to look at all of it. You know, one of the things that I love here, I'm going to quote you, let's face it, your relationship should be easy because you both decide it to be. That means you work together to allow for quick and easy means to both push and limit each other as needed to get things accomplished. That is a beautiful line.
Well, you know, I'm doing an up. Thank you. I'm doing an updated version, a second edition of Wired for Love, and I'm currently, you know, on deadline for it. And I started, you know, I started putting in a section of, you know, stop it or do it, and I'll see how the editors feel about it. But imagine being able to get permission from each other and agree that wouldn't it be easier if during the day. Things that get in the way that you're not doing things or I'm not doing things or you're doing something that's annoying me, that we can just simply say stop it or do it to each other without being offended, right? It may not feel great, but it really actually works. And Trace and I, really, if you watch us on any given day, we're doing that. We get a lot done and we're very friendly and it's funny sometimes. So, but we give each other permission to do it and it's everything's easier for us. But when you think about it, that's how teams work. Stop it, do it. That's how the military works. Stop it, do it. It is a shorthand to stay on task, to stay on mission, to keep focused and not get caught up in arguments that take away from what we're supposed to be doing. So imagine a factory and the people who own the factory are constantly fighting and bickering. Nobody works. No product is produced. If these are parents, the kids are going to be very unhappy. There's no real good parenting happening.
It's almost like you're in an ambivalent state where it's like you can't do or you know, you can't act at all because you're too busy kind of going on the hamster wheel.
And that's a couple that does not have a purpose.
Right.
That's a couple. You know, we have a country that's lost its shared purpose and shared vision. And that's one reason. And we've seen it over history. When that happens, there's civil war. When that happens, there's always civil war because the group isn't unified in a way that makes them feel we may be different, but we're the same. We're Americans. And whatever mythology, true or false, we believe in, it organizes us. When that breaks down, we fracture, we tribalize, and we start to otherize. It's happening in our country, and it happens in marriages. When you and I don't have a shared purpose or vision, we're not focused on things we create and problems we solve. We will turn toward each other and begin to fight. That's everybody. We have to understand that. That's everybody.
Well, I was laughing when you were saying stop it or do it because so the other morning, you know, I'm getting ready to have this instrument check ride and my partner starts making this terrible sound. And I said, what are you actually doing? You know, this the annoyance, right? The irritation. He goes, I'm trying not to cough because I know it's upsetting you.
Oh, that's so funny.
Instead, he's making this even worse sound. And I'm like, just do it already.
That's so sweet. That's so sweet. Oh, sweetheart, thank you so much. You can cough. It's better than what you're doing. But thank you.
I'll tell you, Stan, I lucked out with this one. He is the cream puff of partners. I'm very fortunate. And, you know, I've done a lot of work in attachment in my professional career, but more recently, I don't know if you're familiar with Lori Jean Glass, but I actually went out to the Glass House and did the Pivot program, which is all attachment based, and did a lot of work on my own stuff. So much stuff, complex trauma from childhood and things like that. And it's amazing to see the dynamic shift and even how I'm not getting activated in certain situations. And we already had a fabulous relationship, but this was one where I was like, you know, I want to hold on to this one. I don't want to repeat those patterns you're talking about. Right. So I made sure that I did that. You know, I love chapter 7, messiness and timeliness. I think this is probably one of the most tangible tools for couples out there. You literally give the complaint in action and then examples of how the communication plays out. And I guess you're taking these examples from your clinic, but wow, everything in here that a couple could think of is in here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, I've said for quite a while that the big five is money, time, mess, and sex and kids. And of course, it's not the only thing. But in point of fact, as a psychobiologist who's done this research and continues to, it's not actually the subject matter. It never really is the subject matter, unless it's a deal breaker. We'll get to that in a second. But the subject matter, the topic, is the stressor. The stressor is what leads to a biological breakdown of being able to stay safe and secure in the interaction, both because we're acting in a threatening way to our partner or we're experiencing threat from our partner. And that will always cause us to act and think as a one-person system, which is also threatening to the other person. We'll square off and we'll become adversarial. The real trick here is you and I in relationship, how much stress can we bear or distress and still remain fully collaborative, fully cooperative, and consider each other at the same time we consider ourselves, each other at the same time. That is secure functioning. And that is a very hard thing to do, but a worthwhile thing to practice and get better at, because the world can throw terrible things our way and will do it, like COVID. And if we are not good at this, the wheels of our relationship will come off and everybody is for the worse of it. And that is why it's so important that we practice and learn how to operate as a two-person psychological system, as if we were in a potato sack race. Potato sack race. We want to win. We're not going to if we're too busy trying to fight each other for leadership, right? So, or where we're going to go. We're tied together. We also have to work together and move together given our differences, because we both want to win. We both want to survive. We both want to, feel good about each other. We both want to get along. We have to understand how that works, not because of feeling, but because of very tactical, realistic, practical things that human primates must do. Otherwise, they rob, steal, hurt, kill, run, all sorts of things, because we're animals. And we have a certain nature that we have to understand, including our xenophobia, our racism, and our otherizing, because we do that even with our partners. That's the animals we are. The only thing that keeps us from doing that are shared ideas of governance. Let's not do that. That's destructive. We could both destroy each other. Let's not. That's the only thing that stops us. It's our idea of civilization, of principles of how we're going to protect each other from each other. We're planning for our devils, not our angels. That's smart.
And you're absolutely spot on. And as you were talking about, you know, the COVID component and things like that, I remember reading in one of the chapters about how, you know, the intimacy, sex, and physical health component of things. Yeah. And it's fascinating, because I have couples that will come to me and they'll say, you know, my partner's gained a lot of weight and I'm just not as physically attracted to them. And they have an embarrassment about this. And, you know, I really try to normalize this and say, well, that's natural for you to feel that way, right? There's a lot associated with health that if you're doing a lifetime agreement with someone, you want to know that they're going to contribute in their own health so that the longevity of the team can survive. Yes. What are your thoughts on that?
I own stock in your body. I own stock in your health. You own stock in my health. Any other idea is an idiotic idea. If you get sick, first of all, I waited a long time. This is what my wife tells me. I waited a long time for you. I don't want to lose you. Yeah. I have a selfish interest. You can't do that. But also, you're going to cost me money. I'm going to have to pay for your medical bills. You're going to cost me a lot of trouble. I'm going to have to roll you around in a wheelchair because you're an idiot. And I kept telling you. So this idea of it's my body in love relationships. I mean, it's my body. You can't tell me what to do. Well, there's truth to that. But to say that I don't have any business caring about it is false, because we are interdependent. And interdependence means we have the same things to lose and the same things to gain. And if it's not that way, it's either codependency or dictatorship or slavery, right? But interdependent means you can't do it, I can't do it, so don't. You have to do it, I have to do it. It's in our mutual best interest, so do it. It gives us the power and leverage to hold each other's feet to the same fire that we both have. And that's interdependence. Same things to gain, same things to lose. The field is level. We have equal power and authority. We're both generals. We're both bosses, both executives. Unless I sign away my rights, and if you agree and I agree, that's fine. But it has to be agreed upon, and it has to be done in a sober way to, you know what you're getting into when you sign away your rights. I'll be a passenger. You be the driver. You be the general. I'll be the soldier. I wouldn't do that myself, but people are, you know, can be secure functioning and organize it that way. They just have to agree and be honest about it.
The honesty is so, I think, is so important. You know, one of the things that I really approach all of my relationships with is just don't blindside me, right? Like if you can, even if it's not something I'm excited to hear, I'm going to tolerate and manage those emotions a lot better than if I'm hit with the fry pan over the back of my head.
Yeah. That gets to information. People don't understand that information is one of the greatest commodities in these kind of relationships. Discovery is putting yourself at risk. So, every information is shared with you. You share all the information with me. You're not the gatekeeper of what I should or shouldn't know. I can tell you, I don't need to know that, but that's fine. But if you aren't telling me something and I discover it, that could really take us down. Because I'll consider that a betrayal. If that was important information I should have known and you chose not to tell me, you violated my rights to make decisions based on what is true. You took that away from me, and now that's treason, right? So, secure functioning includes we're fully and completely transparent with each other because we need to be. If we are in charge of everyone and everything, we have to have the same information or we're incompetent. Also, why wouldn't we tell each other everything? What's the point if we don't?
Right, right. Holding back does not do anybody any good, except for that our fears commit. So I want to read this fascinating part of the sex chapter. I really love this. And I think that this is something that comes up so frequently. It says the mind's proclivity for going back is simply nostalgia, a search for the easier, better, more satisfying time in life. The reason we want to go back is because we're afraid of where we are and where we're going. If people can accept their relationship is constantly changing and maturing, it's a good thing. And then it goes on to say, every time we develop more complexity, we review our lives in 360 degrees. That's the way it goes. I love that. Can you elaborate on that for the listeners? I think that is so profound.
So I studied babies and children, and in psychobiology, we're interested in infant brain development and prenatal development and development throughout the lifespan. So we know our numbers. We know when we're going to get brain upgrades, and particularly children. So whenever we get a brain upgrade, we regress. We tend to reach backwards because I've seen the world and I don't like it. And so I want to be younger and dumber because I know too much now. So we'll review, an 8-year-old will review their life in 360 degrees because they have an upgraded brain. And so they're going to think about what happened and what is going to happen in a way they didn't before. So the 8-year-old wants to be 5. The 14-year-old wants to be 8 or 7. We know this. The 50-year-old wants to be 25 again, hair plugs and breast implants and then a Corvette. So this is how we are because it's hard to be in the present moment with knowing things we don't yet have the equipment for to integrate it emotionally because of the way the brain develops. It always develops from the inside out, from the back to the front being the last, and that's the area we use for regulation. So that's why teenagers, seem borderline or narcissistic because they haven't yet caught up emotionally with what they now are able to understand intellectually, or they think they understand. So the brain develops unevenly for everybody, and we're constantly getting these kind of upgrades as we move through time, less so as we get older, but we still do.
And, you know, something that you talk about here is that, you know, as you mature, you start to automate. You automate each other, you automate your life, and then, you know, things are no longer novel. And I think that's what you're describing, is we want to go back to that novelty of the newness or the firsts or...
Well, that's different, though. The automation process is a matter of energy conservation, which is a principle that all biology functions under, right? Nature builds in energy conservation. Otherwise, we wouldn't survive as a species.
Right.
We have to.
Right.
So,
okay.
So we do the least amount necessary. and novelty is very exciting, but anything new is going to become old soon because of the brain's natural tendency to relegate anything that is novel into procedural memory where it's automated. Take, for instance, riding a bike. You ride a bike and all systems are go. All oars are in the water. It's exciting and scary. You're concentrated. You're focused. You're really present. And then you learn how to do it. And now you don't think about it anymore. You don't think about it. You're thinking about other things. Your mind is on to other novelty. You and I meet each other. You're the greatest thing since sliced turkey. I want to know everything about you. I want to smell you, taste you, touch you. I want to, I'm so focused on you. And then I automate you. And you automate me, which makes life easier. But I don't look anymore. I stop being present. I go on to other things. I think I know you, and I don't. It's like learning a little bit of language enough to be dangerous. I don't. I am fooled by the energy conserved state of familiarity, which makes me look away and not still be curious and look at you, which leads to boredom, which leads to looking outside the marriage, which leads to taking liberties and dropping formalities, making assumptions, shortcuts, all sorts of things. So people have to understand nobody gets out of that. This is nature's way of conserving energy. We have to understand it and work against it by spending enough time in every day of being fully present, face to face, eye to eye with our partner, or skin to skin as well, and look at them as the stranger they are and start to wonder again, do I really know you? I don't. I only know you somewhat. Do you realize, by the way, Michaela, that we actually keep a picture, an image of our partner's face or anybody's face for weeks or months without ever looking again? So I don't even notice that you just got a scar or something.
Fascinating. Wow. You're right.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That is fascinating. I love so much what you said about having this curiosity, and this line, I'll read this, folks, listen up to this. Sex without curiosity, exploration, discovery, and up-to-date knowledge of the other and self leads to mechanical sexual behavior, boredom, and eventual loneliness.
Yeah.
And you know, that's just so beautiful. How can you get wildly curious with your partner? How can you be fully present? And I think that part of that automation is that we see them become ships passing in the night kind of a thing, right? That there's almost like a taking for granted. I remember when I lived in San Diego, I used to walk on the beach quite a bit, and I would see couples and families that were sitting at hotels having their dinner. And I thought, they're on vacation. I live here. I never want to take for granted that I live where people vacation. And I had this like fully present awareness every time I'd walk by this certain hotel, you know, that this is a fleeting moment for them. And I want to be a part of this fleeting moment as if it's brand new for me.
Wow. That's the way to do it. There's another way too. Peter Levine, is the well-known somatic experiencing developer and leader and teacher and clinician. His cousin, who is also an important character who passed away some years ago, Stephen Levine, was a Buddhist and talked about death and dying and loss. And he wrote a book, Spend a Year as If you only have a year to live, and everything you do is the last time you'll do it.
Oof.
Right? Think of it as the last time you'll do it. Now, we know that people in the distancing group, in particular, in the attachment, I call them islands, but also they're anxious avoidant dismissive, derogating of attachment values, but they're in the distancing group, tend to deny death and impermanence. And so I really recommend that people take a page from what Stephen Levine is talking about. And even though it seems morbid, keep in mind that today may be the last day you're with your partner. And that is reality. It is, because things can happen that can take another person away. They can, God forbid, get hit by a bus. They can get COVID. Any number of things can happen and do happen to people. And so it's not an unreal thing. It seems morbid, but it allows me to want to say everything I need to say to you today. It allows me to tolerate the annoyance of my child interrupting me every 10 minutes to share something with me when I'm concentrated. I could not see her again. She could decide never to do this and want to see me again because I keep rejecting her. How would I feel? So keeping these things in mind, I think, is the like gratitude is the anti taking for granted and misery, formula, because thinking that you could disappear tomorrow counters whatever urge I have to kick the can down the road or take you for granted. I think it's an important thing.
It's so good. And I'll add that I have a friend whose son took his life, and often she'll post a picture of him on social media and she'll say, I miss you. I miss you. I love you. And every time I see that post, I stop what I'm doing and I text my son and I say, I miss you. I miss you. I love you. And it's something I picked up from her. And I saw something so beautiful the other day that said, everything we say at funerals, we should say at birthday parties. How Yes. much do we not say because we think we'll have time? And I just thought that that was absolutely so beautiful. We all need to take that pause. And how do we create space in our busy lives to make sure that when we feel something, or even if we don't, that we act?
Now, you see, other tribal nations have figured this out. So it's not a new thing. But it does take the ability to have some kind of contemplative or meditative stance to look inside and to look to yourself to see how you are managing your own relationships, to get in touch with your own pain and your own fear of loss. Otherwise, you'll do what most people are doing today, especially because there's so much stimulation and so many attractors out there to take us away from real time, that we don't contemplate, we don't smell the roses, we aren't even, we're not even spending a time to just shoot the breeze with our loved ones, which is something we used to do. So we're kind of reinventing the wheel here, because people should know this is not new. This is, again, solutions to the human condition of loneliness, existential threats, and so on that we've figured out in cultures because it's disturbing and also valuing relationships. So that idea I love, but I can imagine this, some kind of a ritual being there in some tribal area that has not touched Western culture at all, that they would have come to that, right?
I love it. And you're absolutely right. And how did we get so far from that? But just absolutely fascinating stuff. Stan, thank you so much for sharing your incredible insights. And I even, after having read so much of your work, have a different way of looking at things that I'd kind of, decided from what I'd read already. So I just love the insights that you shared today. Where can people get a hold of your book? And always we put everything in the show notes, but where's the best place for people to pick up In Each Other's Care?
Any bookseller at all. It's available audio. I did the audio too on this one, through Audible, through Sounds True, anywhere you want. And if people want to get in touch with me or to find out more about our training programs for clinicians or our couples programs that my wife and I direct, all you have to do is go to thepactinstitute.com. That's the, as in the, PACT, pactinstitute.com. There we have our schedules. We're actually doing a couples retreat in Portugal. These are luxury retreats.
Wow.
And we do couples workshops all the time online. And so that's where people can get all this information as well.
I love it so much. Listeners, Dr. Stan Tatkin, if you love what you hear, go check out their website, The Pact Institute, and find his books. Such fascinating stuff in there for you. And if you thought your relationship was over, you might be surprised to find out not at all. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Stay online for a second because I want to talk to you.
I will do.
This has been a BU Find Happy podcast. For more inspiration, check out the links.